DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Mike Aquilina, who is the author or co-author of over 40 books, including the best-selling The Fathers of the Church, An Introduction to the First Christian Fathers, The Mass of the Early Christians, and Angels of God, The Bible, The Church, and The Heavenly Host. His reviews, essays, and journalism have appeared in First Things, Touchstone, National Catholic Register, and elsewhere. Mike is the Executive Vice President of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, and along with Dr. Scott Hahn, has hosted several popular television series on the Eternal Word television network. With Mike Aquilina, we go inside the pages of How the Choir Converted the World, Through Hymns, With Hymns, and In Hymns, published by Emmaus Road. Mike, thank you so much for joining me once again.
Oh, it's great to be back, Chris. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for writing How the Choir Converted the World, Through Hymns, With Hymns, and In Hymns. Leave it to you to come up with such a great title.
Well, thank you. Originally, my title was Through Hymns, With Hymns, and In Hymns, but my publisher talked me into flipping the title and subtitle, and I think that was a good move. I find that the book has an interesting appeal even to non-Catholics who are interested in the history of Christianity, and they wouldn't get the pun in the subtitle.
Well, I think it's quite a remarkable work because you really chronicle. I can see why those who are maybe not share in our rich Christian tradition, but are love music, can appreciate the history in which you go back and really show how song has been such an integral part of the culture.
Yes, and the Christian religion is an important part of the development of music as we know it today. And so I wanted to try to chronicle that and talk about how Christianity really did inform the development of music, but also how music played a crucial role in the spread of Christianity in that classic period, the period of the early church, the early church fathers.
It really is an expression of relationship with God, because if I'm not mistaken, Mike, even in the Hebrew language, there isn't a word. They don't distinguish necessarily between song and the spoken word. I mean, it's always been thought of as just one blending of a movement. So when we lift up our voices, it naturally elevates into song.
Yes, and song really is a kind of elevated use of the voice. Through music, we imitate the sounds that are there in nature, but also we refine them so that we capture what's beautiful about them. You know, it's quite probable, I'd say, that that primitive peoples were originally imitating the songs of birds. Birds just repeat that same song over and over again. But it's human beings who could take the song of a bird and then make it into something great, make it into something descriptive, put words to it, make it regular, and then improvise on that. It's a beautiful process that takes place because of what we have, what makes us distinctively human, our intellect and our will, and what we find in the history of God's people is that all of those faculties are used in worship. You know, they're all applied there in worship, and they're all elevated. It's a natural process, but it's elevated in worship and perfected.
Mm. And the joy of this is that for those of us who lift up our hearts, especially in these gorgeous songs, we may not even appreciate the fact that we're expressing some of the deepest tenets, the deepest theological understandings of our faith, and yet it has become so rooted in us, we lift it up because it just captures us, doesn't it?
It does, and really, that's how this book came about. I came to the conclusion, after much study of the early church, that music was the primary way those big ideas got communicated and made their way around the world, really. you know, when I first started studying the church fathers, I was drawn to their ideas. I was drawn to their theology. I was drawn to their arguments with one another and with the heretics and with the pagans, all of these great intellectual works. And those are fascinating. But as I studied the fathers more and more, what I came to a conclusion that this really made up just a small part of the life and work of the fathers. By far, the greatest work they had was their pastoral work. They were pastors of congregations, and most of the people in their congregations couldn't read. So they weren't reading the books and arguments that were written out by the fathers. They weren't interested in the academic fine points of Christianity. So it wasn't so much the creeds and councils that were driving history forward as the liturgy. And the most important part of the liturgy in terms of delivering the message wasn't the sermon, it was the songs. St. Basil the Great points that out. He was a great communicator, and he was a great intellectual. He was one of the greatest theologians in all of history. But in one of his great homilies, his first homily on the Psalms, he's saying to the people, you know, when you go home, you're not going to remember the gospel that was read today. And you're certainly not going to remember my homily. But you'll go home singing the responsorial psalm. And all of those ideas will remain with you because of the beautiful melody and because of the poetic expression. And it seems from the historical record that really that's the way Christianity was spread. That's the way it made its way from one person to another, from one home to another, from one land to another.
And it's, you know, I think we can even relate to that even in our present day. I mean, how many of us don't fall into Amazing Grace, for example, or How Great Thou Art at those times when, you know, either at the death of a loved one or at some type of trial or even just celebrating the fact that we've been forgiven. We just naturally fall into it to elevate our prayer of thanksgiving.
Absolutely. Beautiful music moves us. There is no more effective delivery system for ideas. There is no more effective delivery system for emotion, religious feeling, than music. And that's why I think we're wasting some opportunities, because right now, you know, there's a large portion of the population, the only time they darken the doorway of a church is for a funeral or a wedding. You know, they go because they feel some kind of obligation to go. But also, it's an occasion of strong emotion because it's a funeral. It's a parting, an immediate confrontation with mortality. Or it's a wedding. You know, it's a moment of hope in the future. It's a moment that cries out for meaning. So people go into the churches, and sometimes our music isn't what it should be. These are great moments for evangelization. These are great moments to plant those ideas and religious feelings in people's hearts and people's heads and make them, go home singing it, as St. Basil the Great said. So I think that the fathers of the church saw these opportunities, and they made the most of them. They gave people songs to sing, and those songs had rich content, and the content was Jesus Christ.
Mike, you alluded to today and our experience of music, particularly in our worship services, and what is it that somehow we've... I know there are many musicians out there who work so hard and tirelessly to offer up the best that they can, but sometimes the songs just don't capture the same type of expression as they did in the past. Or am I just being reminiscing and feeling sentimental?
Well, I have a theory, Chris. I have a theory that liturgy in every age has always been, for the most part, a problem. That in the average parishes, it's always been it's never really lived up to its potential. If we go back to the writings of the 4th century, the early 5th century, we find great thinkers like St. John Chrysostom, who was himself a reformer of the liturgy, but he was always complaining about congregational singing in his day, you know? So I just have a feeling that it was always a problem. It was always abominable, and it was always something that cried out to be done better and to be reformed. At the same time, I think that in every age there have been examples of those who did it well, did it with excellence, and did it in a memorable and inspiring way. I'm sure Chrysostom, when he took over a church, when he was leading a parish in Antioch, and later when he was leading the church in Constantinople, I'm sure that he strove to make a difference in the way music was done. We certainly have great examples of that kind of musical leadership in some of the bishops and other clergy from the 4th century. St. Ephrem of Syria gathered choirs of women and brought them into the marketplace, and they would just go and occupy the marketplace and sing the doctrine of Jesus Christ. They would sing hymns out there, and they would draw enormous crowds. People would be applauding as they heard these beautiful voices, and he would compose original music for those occasions. So that's one example. In the Western Church, we have St. Ambrose of Milan, and he composed original hymns, and they were memorable. And he used them in congregational worship, but he also used them in moments of civil disobedience. You know, when he was pushing back against the empress, when she was trying to confiscate his basilica, he pushed back. He just had his people occupy the basilica, and what did they do? Well, they did what the great civil rights protesters did in the United States in the 1960s. They sang hymns. In the 1960s, they sang We Shall Overcome, and in the 4th century, in Milan, the congregation sang the hymns that were written by their bishop, St. Ambrose. So there were great figures who arose and gave wonderful music to the church, but I don't know if it was the norm. And today, I think that's the case still. You go to one parish, the music's pretty bad. You go to the next parish up the highway, and it's not so bad. You know, you do find these bright lights even today.
I did think this drives home to the point of why this book is so special in the first place. Again, we're talking with Mike Aquilina about his book, How the Choir Converted the World, through hymns, with hymns, and in hymns. I mean, what's wonderful about it, Mike, is that you bring us to the church fathers who help us to appreciate the gift of faith that we have through these teachings. It's another way to look at that great facet, that all the many facets of that great diamond that mm-hmm. they are sharing with us, and has really revitalized the church.
Yeah, I think so. There has been a renewed appreciation in the life and the teachings of the early church fathers. You know, for a long time we saw these isolated quotations often dragged out as proof texts in apologetic arguments, especially against Protestant anti-Catholicism. But I think that right now we're living in a time where even the Protestant churches are doing such great research in the church fathers, and we're coming to a strong common understanding of what the life of the church was. And I think that so many of the Protestant denominations have rich hymn traditions because from their origins they de-emphasized the sacraments, and so the hymns played a strong part in their worship. So hymns are a place where we can meet with non-Catholic Christians and come to a common understanding of evangelization, what was going on in the early church.
But and as you pointed out with St. Ephrem of Syria and how he would bring the women into the square, into the center, and have them proclaiming and singing this, and like a flash mob almost.
Yes, exactly.
He brought it into the culture. I mean, it wasn't mm-hmm. something that was reserved for just, you know, behind the walls of the church, but it you have to bring this type of expression, this art, into the culture, don't you?
Absolutely. You know, and I applaud the many Christian artists who are trying to do that today. We encounter the culture in so many ways, and our big opportunity, I think, in the parish, is at weddings and funerals. when we suddenly encounter a congregation that is everybody, all of the people, rather than just the select group or the believing group or the people who are motivated enough to show up. No, these are people of all kinds who are there because of their friendship with the bride and groom or with the deceased, and we have a moment. We have their attention, and the strongest way to get people's attention and keep it and then to give them something memorable is through music.
You know, I'm guilty of earlier in our conversation of almost saying that some of our music is not up to the par to what it might have been in the past. But then again, we can't make it so complicated or so structured, which we may do sometimes, that we become more of an audience and not participants. I mean, the goal is for us as Christians to unite in this song together, isn't it?
Yes. And I think that there's room for all kinds of responses to this. There's room for excellence in all sorts of ways. I can't imagine that all of the church fathers responded in the same way to this need for music. I imagine that there were many different ways of responding, partly dependent on culture and fashion and the things that they were responding to. So many different influences played into the development of Christian music, and I deal with a lot of these in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it was, the Jewish background of Christian music, how music was used in the temple and in the synagogue, and the very texts of the Psalms and the poetic structure of the Psalms. All of that played into the development of music, but so did the pagan music of that time, the music that was used in the pagan rites and in the temples, and even popular music that was used for advertising bars and houses of ill repute. All of these things were out there, and they created the musical climate. And the fathers reacted to these things. They reacted against them sometimes. And I'm sure they took the elements that were most successful, and they incorporated them into the music they used in worship. It's always been interesting to me that so many of the songs that arrive in our American hymnals, the old American hymnals, especially those that come to us from Ireland, you have the same melodies being used for hymns that are used for drinking songs in Ireland.
Sorry, I love how the church can transform culture.
That's right.
I love it.
Just slow it down a little bit, and it's a hymn.
I love it. You can get right in there and transform it. And can we give a big, giant thank you to the monastic communities throughout the ages for, keeping us, on track and continuing to offer such wonderful prayers in choir and what they do every day?
Absolutely. And that's another process that started with the early church. One thing that the monks did was regularize Christian music so that it was chanted in the same way day after day. They devised systems of notation. Gradually, they devised certain rules because, every monk follows a rule. They wanted the whole community pulling in the same direction. So a lot of the development of music is due to the fact that that there were these communities that served as laboratories, and not only laboratories, but research institutions carrying the tradition of music from one generation to the next. If there hadn't been monasteries, that wouldn't have taken place in such an orderly way.
I think it is in the holy rule. I mean, that this is what's so different about the Christian monastic experience as opposed to the Eastern monastic experience, where there is a real emphasis on silence. And mm-hmm. But in the Christian monastic community, it is about song. There has to be that built-in time to elevate and to express prayer in song.
Yes. It's interesting just how many of the Christian institutions in that first great period of evangelization, how many Christian institutions created the conditions of possibility for advancement, development, research, and observation. What happened in hospitals, for example, the hospital was a Christian invention. There were no hospitals before there was Christianity, but But having a hospital really did create the conditions of possibility for medical research, because you had a team of doctors, you know, sharing their insights and observing a situation together over a long period of time. And so that's the beginning of medical research, and it's a beautiful thing. Well, I think a similar thing happened in music. You know, you had these monasteries, and they were dedicated to singing these tunes day after day, year after year, century after century. They preserved the tradition, they developed the tradition, they advanced it, really.
Well, you know, I have to say, I do like your idea of having the title be through hymns, with hymns, and in hymns. And how the choir converted the world, I mean, it's a great, but I love the subtitle, because it really is, you're uniting in that great, I mean, it's the Holy Spirit that pulls us up, not only in praise, but also in times of sorrow and in fear. I mean, that's, our hearts cry out sometimes, and song helps in those moments, don't they, Mike?
Absolutely, and that's evident even in the New Testament. I bring that in quite a bit in the book. When Paul and his companions find themselves confined in a prison cell, what do? They sing hymns. And those hymns are for the edification of those around them. You know, certainly they had cellmates. Certainly they had a jailer. Paul and his companions sang hymns about Jesus Christ, and they conveyed the gospel in that way. And what happened? They converted the jailer. They converted their cellmates. We see that in St. Paul's letters, again and again, I use the examples in the book, he's quoting from Christian hymns of that first generation. So Paul was a very early convert to Christianity. But already, by the time he converted, there were Christian hymns. There was already a tradition of Christian hymns, so that he could just quote these willy-nilly in his letters. Again, whenever he did that, he was igniting something in the memory of the people he was writing to. He was igniting something in their memory. He was reviving something. He was reminding them of a feeling they had when they were singing this hymn. At the same time, he was delivering good doctrine. So again, we see these hymns as great conveyors, great delivery systems for both doctrine and religious feeling.
We had quite a touching experience, I think, Mike, you and I shared when we were in Rome a few years ago, where we came across the tomb of Saint Cecilia, who is the patroness of music for the church. We don't know if she ever wrote a hymn or a particular canticle. We don't know if she even played an instrument, but we do know that in the attempt to kill her, and as she lay dying, the reason she's patroness of music, because she encouraged those who waited with her to sing.
Yes, yes, and that tradition has been with us since the time of the early church. When St. Augustine preached about St. Cecilia, this is what he brought up. He brought up her patronage of music, and he used it as an occasion to remark on the singing of ordinary Christians as they went about their work, and how they praised God through the sounds they made. So yeah, this is an occasion of beauty. When we sing in this way, it's an occasion of delight. It's an occasion of teaching, really, as we see in those examples that I mentioned before from St. Paul. Music can do so much, and it does it in a powerful way.
Oh, I had to smile on the chapter towards the end where, of course, you would bring up the Te Deum.
Yes, well, it's one of the great hymns of the early church. You know, it was brought out probably at the end of the 4th century, more likely in the 5th century, and it became the great hymn of the church, the great hymn of praise and thanksgiving. And today we're still singing it. You know, we sing it as Holy God, we praise thy name. Probably the most popular hymn in a Catholic hymnal, if you're looking generally over the last century. The choir director at our parish called it the Catholic fight song and the Catholic national anthem, because when you announce that is the hymn, everybody sings. But the Te Deum, yes, is the great, great hymn of thanksgiving of the church, and it's been around since those early days. So when we sing Holy God, we praise thy name, we are really raising our voices in unison with Christians going back to the very early days of the church.
I mean, we look at that with the Ave Maria. We've heard it throughout time, changed many different versions, but it's the same beautiful prayer.
Yes, and the songs that we sing in the liturgy, the Gloria, the Holy, 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 these songs have been sung by the church from the beginning. You know, they're evident there in the scriptures themselves, but also in every age since then. The fathers of the church attest to the use of these songs in the liturgy from those early days.
Well, Mike, it's the person who not only is excited to enter into just this new, again, it's another facet of this beautiful diamond of our faith that you bring forward to us, and how the choir converted the world through hymns, with hymns, and in hymns. But what would you encourage them, not only just to read, but how do they start to loosen up their vocal cords here?
Well, really give themselves to it. I mean, a lot of people don't sing because they feel like they don't have a good voice. That doesn't matter. And St. Jerome made that point, again, in the 4th and 5th century. Jerome said, even if you don't have a wonderful voice, even if you can't carry a tune, go ahead and sing. Because God does something amazing when the congregation is singing with one voice. God makes the entirety of the song sound good, even if all the individual parts of it are struggling to carry the tune. So really give yourself to singing the song, even if you're insecure about the sound of your own voice. That's okay. You know, just go there and give yourself to the song. The other thing is, you know, for the people on the other end, the people who are planning liturgy, then this is, especially applies to the clergy, but also to music directors and choirs, really give yourself to the preparation of it. Go into it with prayerful preparation, because you are doing one of the most important works of evangelization that will be done in that liturgy. Again, there will be people there at the liturgy who don't really understand the more important parts of the Mass, like the sacrifice, the Eucharistic prayer. They don't really understand what's going on there. They maybe don't have the kind of attention it takes to sustain their interest through a homily, or even through a long gospel. So they may be wandering all over the place in their mind during those parts of the Mass. But where their attention will be riveted is during the music. And the music will deliver them doctrine. The music will deliver them religious feeling. And that will stay with them whenever that melody arises in their mind. You know, advertisers count on this. That's why they write advertising jingles that are catchy and memorable and deliver a message about a product. They want you to remember that. They want that music to come up in your head, in your memory, unbidden, while you're driving your car, while you're mowing your lawn, while you're shoveling snow on the sidewalk. They want that music to arise unbidden and say, I need Doritos. I need a Pepsi. Whatever it is. That's what they want to convey. Well, we're trying to deliver something so great and so marvelous, so wonderful. We're trying to deliver the gospel to these people in a memorable way, and in a way that will just set their hearts on fire when they remember it later. That's the charge of the people who prepare the liturgy, and it's a sacred charge. It's a sacred task, and they should really put themselves into planning the music at least as much as they plan the homily.
Mm. Well, and you know, in the way technology is today, and so many of us with, on our smartphones, and we have music downloaded onto that, and you can even get individual snippets. Now, you don't have to go out and buy a whole CD or an album mm-hmm. of music. Now you can go on and make that a part of your prayer in the morning, or in the afternoon, or on your drive home.
Absolutely. And I'm a big fan of my friend, John Michael Talbot. He's a good friend of mine. I'm a big fan of his music, and I have been for decades now. And it was one of the tapes, cassette tapes, I kept in the car. Actually, two of the cassette tapes I always kept in the car were both by John Michael Talbot. And now my kids as adults say that those songs are the things that just kind of run on the soundtrack in their head all the time, because they heard them while we were driving, wherever we were going, and it was a regular part of their childhood.
And Mike, I'm sure you've heard, and people have shared with you, those poignant stories of parents who now are in those elder years and may be suffering from Alzheimer's or mm-hmm. some type of dementia, and they may not always remember so many things, but boy, when a song, especially hymns, that comes right away to their forefront, and it's amazing how they can complete those.
Yes, a psychiatrist friend of mine was explaining to me it's a different part of the brain. Hymns use a different part of the brain from the parts used by ordinary speech. So there will be people, you know, in a personal care home, they go to the mass that's offered there, and they can't make the responses, you know, the Lord be with you and with your spirit. They can't remember what the response is for that, but they can remember the words to the hymns, and they sing the hymns with gusto, especially the hymns from their childhood. The great philosopher, Marshall McLuhan, had a stroke toward the end of his life, and after his stroke, he lost his ability to speak. It was a terrible thing for a man who had made his living by being a college professor and a lecturer, but he retained the ability to sing hymns. So he was able to sing hymns in those last months of his life, even though he wasn't able to carry on a conversation or deliver a lecture any longer. He could still praise God with his voice.
You praise God in just about everything you do, Mike Aquilino. But
well, we're working on it.
It's absolutely a joy, as always, to read one of your books. And it, you know, what is it the psalmist said? You don't have to sing a perfect song to the Lord. He said, sing a joyful song to the Lord.
Well, I'm doing what I can do. I get lots of good help from people like you, Chris.
Mike, any final thoughts?
Oh, I don't know. Final thoughts. I hope that the book will reach people who are directing choirs and then to reach the people who are singing in choirs, because this is such an important work. And I think that people don't appreciate what music has done through Christian history and the role it's played. In my opinion, the music has been the effective delivery system, more important in many ways than the creeds and the councils and the great intellectual arguments that took place. It was the music that spread Christ through the empires.
I'll just close with Alleluia, but I'm almost afraid to sing it. Alleluia. There, I did it. Hey.
There you go. See, you'll notice I didn't sing anything.
Yeah. Okay. God bless you, my
When dear I can friend. Hide in a congregation, I'll do it.
Yeah, put me in the back row, but at least we're offering it up and God hears our song. Mike Aquilino, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
With Mike Aquilino, we've gone inside the pages of How the Choir Converted the World, Through Hymns, With Hymns, and In Hymns. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to emmausroad.org, the website for its publisher, Emmaus Road Publishing, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this conversation along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, Insights from Today's Most Compelling Authors.